I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Thought we'd talk a little bit about what's going to be happening next year. Start out with the Ukraine. It seems like they continue to pour troops onto the border. Jim, you wrote something about what Russia is doing with their MiG-31s on the border of the Ukraine. What's the outlook going forward there?
Well, the MiG-31 deployment was interesting. I mean, there's a practical reason for it, not to defend Russia from the Ukrainian Air Force, just MiG-29s, but mainly to get substituted for the MiG-31. That is the best interceptor, but they only have fewer than 200 of them in service, and they're going through a major upgrade has embarrassing failures. They're sending some of them down to the border of eastern Ukraine to do reconnaissance. The MiG-31, of course, is the much-improved Cold War era MiG-25, which was originally developed in the 60s and 70s as an interceptor to go after the high-altitude American B-70. After the B-70 was canceled, the Russians said, well, hell, let's not waste this. And they turned it into a high-altitude reconnaissance aircraft, which was very successful. It wasn't as high as the U-2 or the SR-71, but it was the highest reconnaissance and fastest reconnaissance aircraft anyone with money could buy. So they sold a lot of it. In fact, they sold some of it. And then somebody said, gee, you know, let's put a few billion bucks into a new version, which we'll call the MiG-31, as an interceptor, and it turned out to be a very good interceptor. But it's not reliability problems, and they still have to export it, but they can't export it with this dicey reputation. So they're going to the future, as it were, and they've got them flying very high, about 20 or more kilometers in altitude. It enables them to basically take good, high-quality photos. Basically, you stick a reconnaissance camera pod on the MiG-31, and you can see with good resolution over 200 meters into 200 kilometers into Ukraine while staying in Russian airspace. So that's what that was. The Russians have a problem in that, and also because of this, in which they invested billions and billions into their defense companies in the last 10 years to try and upgrade them. So can remain competitive, and it has worked. Their arms sales in 2013, they were $13 billion, and they apparently are going to go up again this year, which is interesting because most European arms firms are declining in sales. American and Canadian arms firms are basically, moving up a little bit, and there's a lot more competition. You got South Korea, China, which is becoming a major producer of older Russian weapons, and of course now the Russians have to use China as a economic and military ally more because of the sanctions, and of course that means they got to sell more of their super. So they're one of their largest competitors is now becoming a more formidable competitor because China is getting more. The high-tech Russian stuff. But the Russians won't be able to keep these investments coming because of sanctions and fracking. So they're fracked.
Russia? Austin?
Well, you ask how Ukraine might evolve in 2015, Dan, and Jim's joke there about being fracked is, and that's one of the unknowns, but certainly something that I has exerting an effect in late 2014, and I see the issue of Russia losing money or what it thought royalties from its oil and gas sales due to the decline in general price of oil, and that has had economic and political effects in Moscow. We have, at the latter part of December 2014, Vladimir Putin telling the Russian people that it's Western sanctions authored by Washington and London that are causing the economic contraction in Russia. I think Jim was already alluding to it. It's, again, the drop in oil revenues that are precipitating it. Certainly the economic sanctions are biting, but the loss of the flexibility from oil provided by $110 a barrel oil versus, I saw a couple of days ago that oil had dropped below $60 a barrel. One grade was mid to high 50. So you've had a collapse of 50% of the price of oil per barrel. And a lot of Putin's muscular foreign policy is supported by the oil revenues and also the strategic threat that it can make to Eastern European and some Central European countries as well regarding natural gas sales. The Russians would even laugh about it. We can strangle you. I've read that actually about 5 or 6 years ago. A Russian manager of one of their pipeline distribution operations was joking about it vis-a-vis, I think it was Ukraine, as a matter of fact. But they've also made the same threat to Moldova and and the Baltics. They imply it when they deal with the Germans and the Poles. But the action this year, invading Crimea and then annexing it, that tore up, just shattered the diplomatic framework for dealing with the end of the Cold War in Eastern Europe. I'm thinking here primarily the Budapest Accord, which we've written about on strategy page extensively. That's changed the perceptions of the Balt and Poland, even though what it did was reinforce their suspicions and fears. Russians have had blowback, too, from Finland and Sweden, where you actually have Finnish and Swedish senior politicians, senior political leaders, elements of political parties in Finland supporting joining NATO. Sweden has said they said it before the little submarine fiasco, Dan. Remember the intruder that was in Swedish territorial waters, suspect Russian spy submarine. They were talking about it before, but while that little incident was continuing, the Swedes mentioned it again. All options for our defense are on the table, and that could include a new strategic relationship with NATO. And that's something that the Kremlin and Putin have provoked by their aggression. It's not an aggressive attitude, outright aggression. I don't see that disappearing. I'm talking about the reactions in the Nordic nations, the Baltic nations, Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, Moldova, and even, Germany, because Angela Merkel's attitudes and public discourse with Putin has altered. She's sounding tough, Dan. I don't see that changing in 2015, and that has effects on Russia politically. It's having effects on Russia economically, and push the situation on 3 or 4 years, and even with the reduction in fracking in the United States will come about due to lower prices. There's still this rising production curve that the United States and Canada are in a position to sell liquefied natural gas to Europe. That cuts out, reduces the effects of the threat to strangle you by not by Moscow threatening to strangle the economies of Ukraine or Poland or freeze the citizens by not selling them natural gas. So this Putin's got himself, in my view, in a very hard place. What is and I see Russia paying a price for its aggression of 2014 and 2015. Now, one of the more interesting speculations I've read about Putin's reaction is the wounded bear syndrome. He's going to get more aggressive. And I don't see the polls backing down. And if the polls don't back down, then you may, if Putin chooses the path of being more aggressive, in other words, pressing the war in eastern Ukraine and openly using the Russian army, could we see an expanded war? And the answer is yes. And notice the way I expressed that, expanded war, because it's not going to start a war. War's already on, Dan.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Jim, what about what's going to happen in the Middle East with ISIL? Where's that headed right now?
Well, that's actually a bit of good news. Well, good news and bad news. The bad news is ISIL is getting ever more vicious, daily. I mean, committing more and more atrocities. And they are hurt very much by the recent Taliban atrocity in Pakistan, where the Pakistani Taliban, which again, say straight up, the Pakistani Taliban and the Afghan Taliban are quite different. The Afghan Taliban is under the control, always has been. It was created by the Pakistani Intelligence Service, the ISI, and the Pakistani military 20 years ago. And they have a sanctuary in Quetta, that's down in Baluchistan in southwestern Pakistan, which has always been off limits, even to American drones. UAV missile attacks. And they have, even they condemned their Taliban brethren in Pakistan for that attack on a school in Peshawar, which is at the capital of the tribal territories, the Pushtun area in the northwest, where the Taliban originally came from. That is associated in the minds of many Muslims, at least a few I've spoken to since this thing broke. There's down on Wall Street. Even though some of these guys I work with or bump into down there, they believe a lot of this BS, like, the 9/11 attacks on the towers was set up by the CIA. I mean, it's amazing to listen to these guys, but anyway, they know they're banking. They condemn the atrocities. And of course, the irony of all this, most Muslims see the Pakistani Taliban, especially their attack on this school that killed over 140, mostly children, young children, and what ISIL is doing, with openly taking slaves and slaughtering, beheading people and what have you, as part of the same problem. And that is a big change, because the problem all along with Al-Qaeda and Islamic terrorism in general, which really got started in a big way in the 1970s. Again, this is history. This is fact. There was a major Islamic terrorist attack on Mecca, the holy place. They actually took the mosque, the main mosque, that Muslims go on their Hajj, their pilgrimage every year. This was sacrilege of the highest order. And the Saudi government put it down severely. I mean, they had gun battles going on inside the Holy of Holies. And this is anathema. But in the wake of that, the Saudis looked around and they realized that these maniacs had a lot of support in Saudi Arabia. They Saudi Arabia condemned the attack on the Holy of Holies, but they said, this whole idea of Islam, radicalism is good because it protects Islam. And again, people in Saudi Arabia, many, and they are taught this as part of their version of Islam, the Wahhabi sect, that it is the duty of Muslims to convert the entire world by force if necessary. That's something our Western leaders refuse to accept. It's politically incorrect, but it's a fact. It's true. You go read Arab language websites. I've done this several times with a translator, you know, standing next to me. Often she's a little, you know, uneasy about translating some of this stuff, but she did it. And it says this stuff. It has been for decades. And the money that the Arab Gulf states, the more wealthy Arabs there supported this Islamic fundamentalism and Islamic terrorism. It's all of a piece. And the concept of war on the non-Muslim, you know, world, which according to the Quran is the enemy of Islam. Islam is a unique religion in that respect, in that the conservatives consider themselves in a state of war with non-Muslims. There are no other religions, and most Muslims do not have that angle to it. And they have created a monster, this goes back to the old Frankenstein story, that got out of control. Yeah, actually, this is an old story, the golem, what have you. You know, all cultures have it, where you create this enormous power, and then it basically goes bad. The sorcerer's apprentice, but with bloodshed. And they are now shifting. Now, it's shifted during the 2004-2008, all the Sunni Islamic terrorism in Iraq. There were opinion polls in the Arab world, which we reported, which showed an enormous shift away from backing Islamic terrorism. But at the same time, we realized this as well, that when the murderous attacks on, you know, mostly on fellow Muslims, and especially women and children, if they were Shia, this, you know, it was just beyond the pale. The public opinion moved back towards approving of Islamic terrorism. But this time it's another shift away from Islamic terrorism. And every time that happens, when it swings back, it doesn't swing back as far. So what we're seeing is by, you know, the bloodshed of these, you know, fanatics, they are changing the outlook, the fundamental outlook in the Islamic world. So in that respect, it's a good thing. It's the only good thing coming out of all this. But, you know, ISIL and their counterparts in Pakistan may be the best thing, you know, we have going for us in terms of countering Islamic terrorism, because the main problem with Islamic terrorism is that it's a fundamental belief. Now, they especially in the West, oh, that's not us. They're not speaking. What have you, but the facts are, and Europeans did this, and they conducted opinion surveys and what have you, that a significant percentage of the Muslims living among, we're talking close to 25 million Muslims in Europe, approve of Islamic terrorism. And that's why you got so many thousands of Muslims, ISIL, in Syria and Iraq. But this backfires. And it's the backfire, which will eventually extinguish the fire, backblast, as it were, because, you know, as long as you have fundamental support for this kind of murderous behavior, it's going to keep coming back. And it's been coming back for over 1,000 years in the Islamic world. I mean, if you look at the history of the Islamic world, you'll see time and again, whenever there is, you know, attempts at modernization, you know, what they call Western education, science, and what have you, there was a back, you know, pushback, often violent pushback, from the Islamic Conservatives, who basically had a veto. And that's why when Muslims talk about, you know, you should thank us for all the work of the evil people, but translating, you know, into Arabic, you know, the ancient Greek and Roman, which our Islamic Conservatives then burned, they leave that part out. They neglected, you know, to mention that there hasn't been anything. There was this huge bounce back, you know, in the 11th and 12th centuries, which basically the Arab world, in terms of technology and scientific and, you know, cultural, never recovered from. And this is a thing that, you know, just doesn't get spoken about out loud in the Arab, in the Muslim world. And you don't hear much about it in the Western world either. It's considered politically incorrect. But again, it's a historical fact. And it's these historical facts which we have to deal with if we're going to deal with Islamic terrorism. So in 2015, I think you're going to see more of a backblast, as it were, from the Muslim world itself. And of course, you've got to remember, that is what, again, this is recent history, which a lot of us, you know, have to be told to remember. In 2008, turned things around quite rapidly, you know, in Iraq, and basically led to what was generally acknowledged as a defeat, a major defeat of al-Qaeda. And they spent years rebuilding. And again, the only main reason they were able to make a comeback was partially because of the Arab Spring, the opportunity to get into Syria and get all this this enthusiasm for throwing out the, you know, the Arab dictators and potentates and what have you. But at the same time, you had this the corruption, which has been in pink, which is another huge problem. Look at the Transparency International surveys. Again, we mention those every year when they come out. They make it very clear that the countries with the greatest degree of corruption tend to be, you know, Muslim. I don't know if it's a cultural thing. I mean, the Romans complained about the greater corruption in the, you know, 1,000 years before Islam even appeared. So we're talking mainly about a cultural thing, not a religious thing. But the corruption, wherever it is, whether it was in Europe, where it took centuries to basically, you know, reduce to a very low levels, it basically stymies sorts of progress. And that's what the Arab world and the Muslim world, the Arabs are hit worst by it. The Muslims in other parts of the world, you know, in Africa, in the Iran notwithstanding, and in Asia, in Southeast Asia, they tend to take their Islam, you know, a little more liberally, less fanatically, and they have prospered in contrast to the Arab world where the Islam came from. So you're talking about a cultural thing, but again, it's more to it's become politically incorrect to talk about, you know, the impact of culture on any kind of progress. But as a historical fact, you can't ignore it.
Yeah. Austin?
ISIL has dug a hole for Jim's analyzed some of the what I'd call level of cultural level issues that ISIL is starting to face, and loss of a moral support or psychological edge among Muslims, beheadings, mass rape, slavery has a very negative effect, as Jim notes. They've also got issues, though, of resupply, and we've covered a little of this on strategy page up there. Could use the weapons, including the armored vehicles that they captured from the Syrian army, but then they also needed petroleum, oil, and lubricant support, ammunition. You could steal some of that from depots and ammo loggers, which they did initially, and also when they went into western Iraq, Anbar province, and into parts of Iraqi Kurdistan with their initial assault. But the ammo up, got to get some more. And they've had problems, even though they can acquire from buying, has been about corruption. One of the things that all sides take advantage of is there's always somebody who's willing to sell something, but sell ammunition, sell vehicles, spare parts, gasoline. But they don't have as much on hand. And there are active measures on the parts of Syrian Kurds where they're supported by NATO, Special Operations Forces, intel, not somebody else can speculate on that. I think there's fairly good evidence that they are, to strike at ISIL logistics points and storage depots, supply depots. That's another problem they've got. How can they keep shooting? They can keep shooting for a long time as light infantry, but a force with aircraft weapons and the line is only so many arrows in the quiver for that. They've also provoked. It's a question as to how effective been, but there are some cases where coalition airstrikes have degraded ISIL combat forces. That happened in eastern Syria and areas along the Turkish-Syria border, Kobani being one of the most prominent. But if even under the very restricted rules of engagement that the U.S. forces and the rest of the coalition operate, and U.S. aircraft to provide the overwhelmingly most powerful part of the coalition air campaign, that still had some effect on them and limits their ability to maneuver and resupply. I don't see that changing in 2015. As for their success in recruiting, I'm just pointing that out, that that seems to be diminishing. They got the initial wave of radicals. They had throughout Europe, North America, and also the Middle East. Some of them are apparently returning home. The recruit base, which surged initially, is not surging anymore. The initial successes are not being, they're not, you know, having more grand successes as they had in June and July and August. The Iraqi military is slowly being rejuvenated to what to something like it was when you had a U.S. sustaining U.S. Military and security presence prior to December 2011. How long that's going to take? I'd be interested in hearing Jim's estimate on that. But one of the key elements of the new U.S. training force in Iraq, and there's a larger training cadre, it's probably going to be or is being supplemented by NATO members, is crackdown on corruption in the military. No more ghost soldiers, and officers are going to be assigned based on their proven military capabilities and not on their connections to the Shiite politicians and that are still the most powerful political group in Iraq. And part of the reason that government is listening, the government is listening to U.S. advisors, admitting U.S. advisors, there are two. One, it's the survival of the state requires it. And secondly, Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani he was advocating that. The attacks on corruption and a military run based on competence well before ISIL launched its attacks. He was behaving not only as the grand leader of Iraqi Shiites, he was behaving as a committed Iraqi nationalist for the good of the entire country. So, and he still has a lot of influence, and his influence has not been decisive, but there are plenty of Iraqis and sit there and say, you know, we should have listened to this old man because he really is wise. And what he was saying was good of all of us. We had not let the Maliki government go about giving away senior officer slots to its supporters. So,
okay. Yeah. Well, One question to wrap this all up, as we're starting to run out of time here. What, Jim, is going to be the biggest surprise in 2015 that people aren't thinking about right now?
I would say that in Iraq and Syria, it's fairly obvious that, you know, ISIL is on the defensive, and that's probably not going to change. American military advisors have said that the you'll have enough Iraqi reconditioned combat brigades in early 2015 to start a proper offensive. And they're talking about not just having enough troops to attack with, but enough troops to also, you know, occupy areas that are taken back from ISIL. The problem with corruption and poor officers was spotlighted 5 months ago when the first wave of American advisors to go back there did a analysis. Again, these were guys who, many of these guys had trained Iraqi troops and officers, you know, before 2011. And they evaluated all the brigades, and they said flat out that half of them are incapable of combat because they've got all these incompetent, corrupt officers. Now, the new Prime Minister, Abadi, he is eager to get rid of all the officers appointed because they were buddies of Maliki, you know, the former Prime Minister. Unfortunately, I'm already getting reports that he's insisting that officers be appointed who are, among other things, loyal to him and his buddies. So you know you're just getting another bunch of incompetent officers. And now, as Austin pointed out, when you have American advisors there, and that's one reason why the many prominent Iraqis were eager to get the Americans completely out, was they were an inconvenient witness to the incompetence of these appointed officers. And now they're there again, and they're speaking out. You know, these guys have been through this before. So you've got this back and forth, and you'll see stories appearing next year about American advisors, you know, arguing with the new administration in Iraq about the officers being appointed and what have you. Plus, you have the old problem of the shortage of competent officers, period, in Iraq. Short loyal officers, I mean loyal to the government, not necessarily certain politicians. Because when Saddam was overthrown and you had they decided to eliminate, you know, just disband the Iraqi military. That was done mainly because almost all the officers were selected primarily for their loyalty to Saddam. They were all Sunni Arabs, and very few of them could be trusted. And of course, that got mixed up in political correctness. No, no, it was a bad thing to do. No, it was the only thing you could do. But the problem there, and we reported on this regularly for years, was they had to rebuild from scratch. I mean, at best you had some junior officers in reserves and a lot of NCOs who were Shias, but they had to be trained. You can't make an officer, especially a battalion commander or brigade commander, overnight. They've got some junior officers that you can move up to battalion and brigade command, but again, a lot of them are more inclined to hitch their star to their military future to a politician who will ask them to do things they shouldn't do, like, you know, bring back ghost soldiers. And this is still a problem. But ISIL is in worse shape. They have corruption problems as well. They've been executing people for corruption, which a lot of Iraqis admire. But the problem is still there, even if the penalty is death if you're caught. And as Austin pointed out, they have an economic problem because they have, 4 or 5 million people within ISIL-controlled territory, and the economy has to function. And reports are coming out, especially from Mosul, the economy is not functioning. People are very poor. They're basically dependent on free food from the Iraqi government. The Iraqi government, for example, is still paying the salaries of a lot of civil servants who are now working for ISIL. And they do this primarily to maintain some vestigial loyalty with these people. ISIL needs them. ISIL knows that these people know where their pay is coming from, but ISIL is in a desperate situation. They got to have food. They got to have fuel. And it's not just the military, the fighters, the 20 or 30,000, you know, armed people, you know, supporting ISIL, but it's the millions of civilians. These people get too hungry. You've got an uprising. Well, you've already got an uprising, but the hungrier they get, the poorer they get, the more desperate and violent they get. So ISIL, forget about it. Russia, now that's going to be another surprise. What is Putin going to do? He started this whole, you know, NATO is trying to destroy us routine as part of his nationalist, you know, political platform, you know, to turn Russia back into a dictatorship with him as president for life, pretending to be a democracy. But it all depends on him maintaining this image, as it were, of they're under siege from NATO. Well, they are under siege from NATO now. They weren't before, but they certainly are now because of what they did in Crimea when they did in Georgia back in 2008 and they're doing in Ukraine. And if he backs off, he loses face, he loses power, and you get instability in Russia. Now, his economic experts, I'm getting this from Russians, you know, or bankers downtown who have connections, you know, work with their counterparts in Russia, and they're saying Russian bankers are telling Putin, look, it's the numbers. you can't dance your way out of this. Basically, the West has cut us off. Even Russians aren't willing to invest in Russia anymore. Russia's got this huge, you know, capital flight problem. So there's no, the economy is tanking. Even the official, you know, numbers from the Russian government are recession next year. That's what they're admitting to. You can imagine what it's probably really going to be like. So what's going to happen there? You know, not good for Putin. Hopefully he won't do something crazy. One never knows. I tend to be an optimist. Putin and his crowd are basically the KGB, the Cold War crowd. During the Cold War, it was generally known, at least among intelligence, you know, the community in the West, that the KGB were very bright. In other words, if you wanted to get ahead, if you were a bright young lad in the Soviet Union, you got into the KGB because basically you could only be arrested by another KGB guy and you could, had plenty of opportunities to basically have a good life. But those guys are basically fading away, literally. Younger Russians do not support Putin as much as older Russians. And the older Russians are dying. So time is on our side, but the question is, will Putin push the button in the meantime? I doubt it, but he's got the button, and he's got his own self-inflicted pressure building on him to somehow pull, you know, this mess out of the fire. So that's going to be it. China, they have adult, you know, they're a communist dictatorship, but at least they got adult leadership. You know, more mature, you know, leadership going on over there. So they're still going to, and they're playing the same nationalist game. Hey, we're beset by enemies. You have to do whatever we tell you. Otherwise, we're going to be, you know, destroyed by the West, by America, what have you. That is starting to get to the backfire stage because their expansion, you know, they're going against India, the South China Sea, what have you. They have internal economic problems and demographic problems, which are catching up with them, which, again, are not news, but they are the fundamentals of what China's future is. Whatever the newspapers say, the fundamental economics, you know, dictate what actually happens. And the fundamentals are not good for China. So they have to cope. But that's not something that's likely to go boom. Whereas ISIL can get bloodier.
Austin, why don't you give us your view of what the biggest surprise could be in the coming year?
Well, I don't think it's a surprise. I agree with Jim. He just said that, you know, ISIL could still go boom. He's right. Yes, I showed you, or at least made an argument that ISIL is support is eroding. Jim made that same argument as well. They're in a tough situation. And Jim and I have debated. We have different views on the U.S. Snap decision to get rid of the Iraqi army in May or early June of 2003. But his point about rebuilding the army was a requirement.
All right, that finishes up my bit. Go ahead, Austin.
Yeah.
All right. That's Jim's point on that is correct. I think there were other ways to go about handling all the couple of hundred thousand young Iraqi troops running around in May of 2003. But he's right. That is especially if we see this improved and rejuvenated Iraqi force employed in early to mid 2015 against ISIL. You see a significant some heavy fighting, Dan. I agree with Jim's analysis, pretty much in line with mine about Putin. It's tough to say what he's. Remember, I used the term the wounded bear scenario. It's tough to say what he's going to do. And China, we've discussed China this past year several times, and its aggressive claims on the maritime boundary in the South China Sea. But as I was pointing out, they are now running into a lot of resistance from their neighbors, Vietnam, Philippines, South Korea, Japan, and the issue is how tough are you going to be making your nationalist claims when at the same time your economy is so essential to your domestic stability. And all of those countries, Japan, South Korea foremost, but all have significant trade relations with the Chinese as well as the United States. And the United States is already an ally of Japan and South Korea and the Philippines, and we're becoming a de facto ally of Vietnam. And the reason is Vietnam feels that it is being attacked and threatened by Beijing.
Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to next year. I'm sure there'll be lots of stuff for us to report on, and Happy New Year. See you next year, guys.
Same to you, Dan.
Bye.